I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. Thank you so much for tuning in to our fall season, and thank you for listening to all of our series and supporting us all these years. I want to ask that you please support our sponsors because our sponsors support us, and a big thank you to them. Without them, we couldn't continue to do the work to help the wrongfully convicted. The second thing I want to say before we dive into today's episode is this. Whether it's this case or any other case that we've worked on, we've actually got a tip line. So if anybody out there has some information they think could help us in our investigation into this case, the State versus Greg Lance, or any of the cases we've worked on, please give us a call. The tip line is 410-205-5563. Once again, the tip line is 410-205-5563. Around 10:30 a.m. on the morning of Sunday, August 2nd, 1998, in Rickman, Tennessee, about 15 miles north of both the Kolesnikow property and the Ford Mobile Home Park, a woman named Judy Wells and her partner, Joel Brown, heard gunshots coming from their neighbor's property. It sounded like someone doing some target practice in one of the numerous buildings next door, on a farm that belonged to a man named Mike Heron. At the time, Heron didn't live at the farm. In fact, it was up for sale, and he lived in Southern California. His neighbors apparently kept an eye on his place, though, which was the neighborly thing to do, and he let them graze their cows on his property, also the neighborly thing to do. Heron's farm had a few structures on it, including a main house, a barn about 50 yards behind it, a tool shed, and a garage. McPhee Lane ran on the left side of the property, and if you followed the gravel lane back about 250 yards to where it ended, you would arrive at Judy Wells and Joel Brown's home. A tract of land separated the two properties, land that dipped behind the barn and then rose back up towards Judy and Joel's house, with lines of trees between the two, creating privacy. But not enough privacy or distance that they couldn't hear the guns going off that Sunday morning. Someone was trespassing on Mike Heron's farm, as well as interrupting their quiet weekend morning. And that was just the start of what was going to be a very strange week, in fact, a very strange month, with all kinds of odd comings and goings at the Heron farm. But when they learned about the fire at the Kolesnikows, which took place 3 days after they heard that Sunday morning gunfire, it all started to make sense. Welcome to Undisclosed. This is the third episode in our series on the State versus Greg Lance, the Heron Farm. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
A police dispatch log for August 2nd, 1998 shows that at around 2:30, Judy Wells called the cops to report gunfire. She wanted the police to come out and take a look at what was going on. When the police arrived, her husband Joel, who went by Joe, told police that he had been checking his electrical fence when he heard gunfire that morning. He said it sounded like different caliber weapons, two or three different kinds, he wasn't sure. From where he'd been out checking the fence, he couldn't see anyone, so he walked into a small grove of trees in the hollow between the two properties. He would have been peering up towards the back of the Heron barn from about 100 yards away, But even though he'd moved closer, he still couldn't see who was doing the shooting. He decided to get a closer look, so according to both his statements in 1998 to the TBI and at trial 2 years later, he got in his pickup and drove up the road towards the shooting, where he noticed a squat red car with a hard top that was pulled up behind the garage, largely hidden from view. At trial, Joe noted that he pulled into the circular gravel driveway behind the Heron house to get a better look, but because he only had one good eye, he couldn't make out the plates of the car. But he did note that the car had Humphrey County plates, which was a county about 160 miles west from where they lived. As he stood in the driveway, the shooting began again, and he drove away to return home. He didn't want any trouble. Shortly thereafter, his old lady, in his words, left to fetch her newspaper from the store, which was sometime between 12:30 and 1 p.m. After getting her paper, Judy went over to a friend's house to have some coffee, and she told her friends about the shooting. She was told to call the police to report it, and she did. That's that 2:36 p.m. call that she placed while still at her friend's house. By the time the police arrived, nearly an hour later, the shooting was long over, and no one was there on the Heron property. The police didn't even bother to get out of the patrol car. They just did a round of the circular driveway, saw that all was quiet, and drove on.
But Joe wasn't satisfied. He wanted to see if the shooters had left empty shells in the barn. That way he could tell how many different kinds of guns had been fired. One of the guns had been so loud, he described it sounding like a cannon to TBI agent Bob Krofsik. So Joe returned to the Heron barn that same evening and poked around, looking for shell casings. Inside the barn, he noticed that the half door that opened to a small room that he called the harness room was firmly shut closed. That struck him as odd, because all summer that door had remained open. He should know, he was up on the property multiple times a week. He knew that just inside the half door was a short flight of stairs that led into the loft of the barn. So he thought that since there weren't any shell casings in the main level of the barn, maybe the shooters had been firing the guns up on the loft. Joe opened up the door into the harness room and stopped in his tracks. In front of him sat two large, dark, 5-gallon gas containers, military style, blocky, with flat bottoms. He prodded the cans with his cane. They were definitely full. He unscrewed the lid from one of them and took a sniff. It was gasoline. A week earlier, he had done the rounds with another neighbor, Steve Powell, who lived on the other side of the Heron farm. At trial, he testified there were no gas cans there the last time he had been there. The shootings and the appearance of these mysterious gas cans alarmed Joe, so he told Krofsik that, quote, he got the hell out of there. Joe thought that given the quantity of the gas, maybe someone was planning on burning down the barn. Joe checked in the barn again the next day, on Monday, and there were the gas cans again, still full, still right inside the half door. That was when he gave Steve Powell a call, asking to come and take a look at something. In his police statement, Powell confirmed Joe's account. He had gotten a call from him after work that Monday and gotten to take a look at what Joe had found in the Heron barn. He saw the two plastic gas cans, wider than they were tall as he described them, about 5-gallon cans in his estimation. He checked the liquid levels in both cans and saw they were full. Powell's statement said at that point, quote, after we saw the cans, we left because that's all the prying I wanted to do. Interestingly enough, while both neighbors were supposed to be keeping an eye on the farm, neither of them reached out to Mike Heron, the owner of the property, to tell him anything about the gunfire or the gas cans. Anyhow, Joe kept checking in the barn to see if the gas cans were still there. They were there Monday evening, as Powell confirmed, which was August 3rd. They were there Tuesday evening, August 4th. But come Wednesday morning, the morning of August 5th, the morning the Kalisnikows were murdered, the gas cans were gone.
I have been using Vistaprint ever since I became a small business owner a long, long time ago, like well over a decade ago, because I've had a lot of different small businesses. I've had my own law firm, I still do. I've had a law enforcement training firm. And now I own partially this podcast. This is also a small business. And for anybody who has a small business, you know how important it is to look polished and professional and be ready for any opportunity that comes your way. That means having marketing materials on hand. That means having beautiful business cards. You don't want it to look like you just printed them up from your own printer, believe me. But also, it has to be affordable. And that's why I love Vistaprint. First of all, I'm not a graphic designer. I don't know how to make things pretty, but you don't have to know any of that with Vistaprint because they have so many different templates and you can choose whatever style, finish, shape, or paper you like. You can pick the colors, fonts, designs, and images. You can just create something as unique and compelling as your own business. And of course, if you have your own design and logo, you can just plug that right in and create your business cards using that. Look, your next big opportunity is coming right now, and Vistaprint is here to help you own the now with free shipping on any business card in any quantity. And as if you needed any more reasons to choose Vistaprint, you can feel good knowing that Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed or your money back. They will make it right. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get free shipping on all business cards, any style, any quantity. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter the promo code UNDISCLOSED2 for free shipping on all business cards, any style, any quantity. Limited time offer. Own the now at Vistaprint.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED2. That's promo code UNDISCLOSED followed by the number 2. Remember, you support our show when you support our sponsors. The August 2nd shooting wasn't the only funny business that happened at the Heron Farm that week. Woven throughout Judy and Joe's rambling statement about the gunfire and gas cans was another weird story. The appearance of a group of strangers and a U-Haul truck. In the same August 20th police interview with Agent Krofsik, Judy recounted seeing three people at the farm as she drove by to fetch her paper on August 2nd around 1 p.m. A young man with dark hair, a blonde-haired woman, and a dark-haired woman. Apparently, when she drove past them, she saw the women sitting on a concrete slab close to the porch of the house, and it seemed like they were either high or drunk, falling over each other and on the ground and helping each other up. There was a brown Oldsmobile-looking car with a vinyl top with the trunk open, and the red car her husband had seen earlier was still pulled to the side of the garage. As Judy drove by, she quickly glimpsed the man standing behind the open trunk of the brown car. Judy says a couple days later, on Wednesday or maybe Thursday, she again saw a group of people at the Heron Farm. Another blonde-haired woman, a dark-haired woman, and this time two men. She saw them get out of their car, this time a red car, walk into the barn, then come right back out and get in the car and leave. Now, her husband doesn't mention seeing any of these people on either day. Maybe he didn't witness them. It's hard to tell because Krofsik doesn't even ask him. Judy doesn't mention what time of day she saw the second group of people or how she saw them, and she doesn't even state whether or not they were the same people she had seen a few days earlier. And again, Krofsik doesn't push her. He doesn't ask her many clarifying questions. The only additional details Judy gives are that the man standing behind the brown car on that Sunday was young and had dark, well-groomed hair, and the woman with blonde hair had a tattoo on the back of her shoulder. Again, were these the same people she saw a few days later with the red car? Maybe.
Then there was the U-Haul. While Joe apparently hadn't seen any of the people that Judy had, he mentioned seeing a U-Haul to Krofsik. He said it had been loitering around the Heron Farm one evening. Although Joe's interview with Krofsik is so incoherent in places and his trial testimony so rambling that it's hard to say whether he actually saw the U-Haul himself or just had heard about it from others. Because when you cut through a lot of the double talk, it seems like Joe may have heard about the U-Haul from his neighbor Steve Powell rather than having seen it himself. But there was a U-Haul, according to Powell's testimony. He'd seen it one evening as he was driving past the Heron Farm on his way to visit Judy and Joe. The U-Haul had been backed up to the barn, and someone was inside. Powell saw that the interior cab light was on inside the U-Haul truck. A large white male, around 180 pounds, he estimated more or less, had sat inside the cab of the vehicle. And then, about an hour later, when Powell drove by again, the truck was gone. While both Steve Powell and Joe recall this happening around dusk, it's only Joe that's able to pinpoint a date for this. In his trial testimony, Powell says that he has no recollection of what date he saw the U-Haul on, and oddly enough, in his original police statement, the U-Haul is not mentioned at all. Only Joe, in his August 20th interview with Krofsik, identifies the date of the U-Haul being on the Heron property as Tuesday, August 4th, which is an important date because that's the night the Klesnikows ended up being murdered. So what does all this have to do with the Klesnikow case? Why are Judy and Joe giving TBI agent Krawczyk, the lead investigator in the case, this interview 15 days after the couple was killed? Well, after reading about the demise of the Ukrainian couple, Judy and Joe placed a call to the fire marshal, Philip Gentry, because they believed they had information that connected to the crime. Even though Judy and Joe hadn't actually seen anyone do any shooting on Sunday the 2nd, or recovered any shell casings, or seen any bullets in the barn, they had a hunch that the shooting of gas cans and the strange people in the U-Haul, basically all the weirdness that had gone on at the Heron Farm the week of the murders, was somehow connected to the crime. Their hunch probably didn't seem like such a leap to Krawczyk, though, because he already knew that Greg Lance was no stranger to the Heron Farm.
In that same August 20th interview, Krawczyk asked Judy and Joel if they knew Greg Lance and what they knew about him. While they didn't know him personally, they knew that Greg worked with Mike Heron in construction projects and had seen Mike bring over Greg's tractor to his property in the past to do some bush hogging with it, which is nothing like it sounds. No hogs involved. It just means clearing land with a bladed device attached to a tractor. In other words, mowing tougher vegetation than a lawnmower could handle. Beyond that, they didn't know Greg personally, but they did know that at some point in the past year, he'd been on Mike Heron's farm shooting. Krawczyk apparently already knew this, as we can tell from this exchange. Referring to Greg and Mike, Krawczyk asks, question, okay, but you heard them shooting at two different places here over a year or so. Answer by Joel. About 2 years ago when they were doing the shooting target practicing down there in the woods, and it was Sunday before the house burned up in Cookville, they was up here in that barn shooting. Question, okay. Answer by Joel, but I didn't see nobody now because, answer by Judy, you could just hear him. And it's true. Greg had been at the Heron Farm shooting guns, just like Joe said. Mike Heron and Greg had known each other since about 1996, when Mike responded to an ad in the paper that Greg had placed, looking to hire a construction job superintendent.
Greg was running an ad in the paper as a contractor, and I answered the ad, and we started building together. Basically, I worked with him. It was pretty much me, him, and we had some other workers, but Greg had the license, and I have a huge, long construction background. So, when I first got with him, we did some concrete work, and then we started building the baseball field and stuff there in Cookville. We did Halleck Myers. We did the baseball park for the city. We did a bunch of jobs together.
Mike Heron testified at trial that he and Greg didn't just work on outside projects. They spent a lot of time helping each other out in their own properties. Greg replaced Mike's roof, and Mike did a lot of work on Greg's mobile home park.
We busted our butts working out there on it all the time, and money wasn't a problem.
Did you work on the? You worked on the trailer park with him?
Oh heck yeah, man! We put in sewer lines. We built the storage buildings. Oh yeah, he worked on that place. He put money into it. I mean, he had extra money. He was buying the doors for the storage units. We worked on maintaining that thing almost daily.
Wow.
Up until the time I left there, that place was like priority to him. I mean, if we weren't working on a job, he was spending his time and money at that place.
They worked together and played together, too. At trial, Mike Heron told the jury that they would gather with other friends at the farm to barbecue and, more importantly, target shoot on his 26 acres. Mike estimated that Greg had gone shooting with him at the farm at least 3 or 4 times. Mike owned a range of guns, including high-powered rifles, 45s, 9mm, 38s, and others, but when he first met Greg, all Greg owned was an old shotgun. Over the years, however, Greg had acquired other weapons, including one that Mike himself had gifted to Greg on his birthday, and Greg promptly tried out. Greg's birthday is in late November, so that gift of a gun had to have been in November 1997 or earlier because by the following November in 1998, the Klesnikows had been murdered and Greg certainly wasn't doing any practice shooting anywhere. If it was November 1997, it still wasn't the last time that Greg had been shooting at Mike's farm. Mike Herron moved back to California in March of 1998, but before he left, he had a little bit of a party at the farm. Greg was there, along with his girlfriend Becky, Keith was there, and a handful of others. Together, they grilled, ate, drank, and they shot guns. But the day became more eventful than they could ever have imagined, though, when Greg himself ended up getting shot.
Mike Herron gave me a 38 for my birthday, and that was one that we were at Herron Farm shooting. His going away party the day I got shot. He shot me in the back.
That's a crazy story.
Another 38 that was from like a really old Civil War type officer's revolver that was that wasn't in operating condition. That was a breech loader.
No idea what that means.
And it broke in. It would break in half, and you'd load it like that.
Oh, I've seen that in the movies. Okay.
The one Mike Herron gave me was like the, like you see in the westerns where the revolver, the cylinder comes out the side, and you load it.
Is that what you got shot with?
No, Keith shot me with a .22 rifle that he bought from somebody there at the party. Somebody had a .22 rifle for sale, and Keith bought it from him. Well, I was standing there taking a leak, when I got shot and I fell down to my knees, with my junk still hanging out, with this terrible pain in my back, and I reached back there and touched it, and there was a hole, and then I looked at my hands, and there was, blood on my hand, and it's like, oh, no, I've been shot. Oh, it was down in the woods, going around shooting stuff here and there. I was kind of down in a depression type area. I didn't think he could even see me from there. And I was off to one side quite a ways. Evidently, the bullet caught the edge of the tree and bounced. It altered the trajectory. And enough that it hit me in the back, just to the left of about 1 inch to the left of my spine, right between my shoulder blades.
I mean, you got lucky, though. I mean, considering it could have been a couple inches to the right.
This incident of Greg getting shot is confirmed by nearly everyone who was there. At trial, Mike Herron testified that they had tried to take the bullet out themselves in his kitchen using a knife, but he realized they were in over their heads. Greg didn't want to go to the hospital. He had no insurance and he didn't want to spend the money because he was kind of frugal, but his friends were having none of it. So they took him to the hospital where he got stitched up, but to his surprise, the doctors found no bullet.
Made a hole and left a scar, but I got to the hospital, they couldn't find the bullet.
That's crazy. They never found a bullet?
No, never found the bullet.
Where do you think that bullet is?
It must have fell out, on the way back, because we had to walk quite a ways, back up to Mike Herron's house, through the woods and, across the fence and stuff. Took a probe down in there, and they're like, well, there's, we can't find any bullet in there, and x-rayed me, couldn't find a bullet. So they just, of course, shot a little Novocaine in there before they started probing. Went ahead and just put a stitch across it, the bullet hole, which I don't know why you'd even bother doing that.
Because Greg had no health insurance, Keith, who was insured, signed Greg into the hospital as himself. I can't help but think Keith felt a little guilty. Anyway, whatever medical record that might have existed with this incident, which could help establish the date that all of this happened, is in Keith's name, and Greg has no access to them. And we can't get them through Keith either, because he passed away years ago, on April 25th, 2013, at the age of 49. But back in 1998, Keith, Kay, and Becky all told investigators the same thing. That was the last time they were aware that Greg went shooting at the farm, nearly 5 months before the Klusnikows were murdered.
With prices going up on just about everything lately, dealing with money can be stressful. If you follow stories about wrongful convictions, you know that details matter, and the same goes for your finances. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses in one place, including subscriptions you may have forgotten about. Their dashboard lays out your total financial picture in a way that's easy to understand. Rocket Money's 5 million members have saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, with members saving up to $740 a year when they use all of the app's premium features. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/budget today. That's rocketmoney.com/budget. rocketmoney.com/budget.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Twenty out of every 1,000 households were burglarized in 2017. And what's crazy is that only one in five homes have home security. Maybe because most companies really don't make it easy. They hide the ball on prices, and they require you to lock into long-term contracts. That's why SimpliSafe is my top choice, hands down. SimpliSafe protects every door, window, and room with 24/7 professional monitoring. They make it easy. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. And it's won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. Prices are always fair and honest, and they have around-the-clock monitoring for just $15 a month. But one thing that truly makes SimpliSafe stand out is their video verification technology. When other home security systems are triggered, a lot of the time police assume it's a false alarm, and the call goes to the bottom of the list. But not with SimpliSafe. Using their video verification technology, they're able to visually confirm that the break-in is happening, allowing police to get to the scene 3.5 times faster than other home security companies. And now for my listeners, SimpliSafe has a huge deal going on right now. Go to simplisafeundisclosed.com and get free shipping and a money-back guarantee. That's simplisafeundisclosed.com today. simplisafeundisclosed.com.
The plot kept thickening, though. Or at least it did for the Clifton Cowell murder investigation. And the August 20th interview wouldn't be the last time that they'd be summoned to the Heron property. Within a week of TBI agent Krawczyk's interview of Judy and Joe, another string of very peculiar events took place at the farm. On August 25th, neighbor Roberta Powell, Steve Powell's wife, heard her dogs barking angrily at something next door. She went out to take a look, and that's when she noticed smoke coming out from the Heron property. When her husband, Steve Powell, returned home from work not long after, he noticed the same thing, that their dogs were barking out towards the Heron farm. As Powell said in a police statement the following day, there was smoke coming from the Heron property, and he tried to identify what was burning and where, but couldn't see exactly where it was coming from. All he could tell was that it looked like it came from between the barn and the house. Though his wife, in her testimony, described something slightly different. At trial, Roberta said that when she came out to see why the dogs were barking, she looked over at the Heron property and saw a, quote, gentleman there tending to the fire and saw a pickup. Roberta went on to say that she saw only one man, and she wasn't sure if it was a brush fire or a trash fire or what exactly he was burning, but she could see that the fire was on the ground and not in the barrel. She could also see a truck, or at least the cab of a truck, and it was blue. Although at trial, when Greg's attorney prodded her on what she could see and whether she had a good view, she said no, her view was obstructed. Later on in her testimony, she stated that she was about 50, 60 yards away at the time, and there was brush in the way. After showing her an aerial photograph of the wooded area between where she was and where the fire and truck were, the attorney asked her, "How on earth did you see it?" "I don't see how on earth I did," she responded. And that's probably the truth, that she wasn't able to see anything from her property. But when testifying over 2 years later, her memory was clearer. Because she definitely did see a truck, just it wasn't until later in the evening, when she and her husband took a drive to have coffee with their neighbors, Judy and Joe, and passed by the Heron farm. And that, according to Steve Powell in his interview with the police, is likely what actually happened, and when and where she saw the truck. Because when they were done visiting the neighbors and headed back home, the truck was no longer in the Heron farm. Now, before they'd headed over to Judy and Joel's that evening, the Powells had called ahead to ask them if they knew what the smoke was all about, but Judy and Joel said they had no idea. Once they'd been alerted, though, Judy was on the case. In a police interview taken the day after the smoke incident, Joel had stated, quote, "My old lady, Judy Wells, she said she could see a two-tone pickup truck, I think a Ford. She had seen smoke and people, too, walking around." Judy had also been interviewed, and she stated that, quote, "The neighbors came over and the vehicle was still there. It was a blue and white truck." A couple of years later at trial, Judy stated, quote, "We looked out and there was a blue and white Ford truck sitting there by the garage." She also testified that she saw the truck move and that two men were in the back of it.
Now, here's the problem. I've been out to Judy and Joe's house, which still stands in exactly the same place. They don't live there any longer, but looking out from the front of their yard and across into the Heron property where a new barn stands in the place the old one used to be, you can't see a damn thing. It's true that both properties are on a bit of a rise, but it's barely a rise, and the ridges of trees between them come up so high and so thick, you can hardly see the actual buildings on the other side. And the truck and people that they say they saw would have been on the opposite side of the barn, about 2 football fields away. I took a picture, which we'll post with the episode documents on our site, so take a look yourself. Now, it's possible Judy, who seemed awfully eager and excited about all the happenings, so much so she called the fire marshal again the next day, was nosing around with binoculars, and that's how she could see so far. But it still wouldn't explain how she could see through solid objects like trees and an actual barn and identify what was happening on the other side. Frankly, it's not likely she could or that she did.
Anyway, speaking of calling the fire marshal, the next day, Joe again did what he thought a good neighbor would do and went poking around in the Heron farm to see what had been causing the smoke the previous day. Around 11 a.m., he went to check in the cows and then check out whatever had been on fire. According to the police statement that he gave the same day, he saw some burnt firewood and something brass-looking that was glinting and lodged in the wood. Taking his pocket knife, he turned the wood over and a shell casing fell out. That's when he had Judy give Fire Marshal Gentry another call. At this point, TBI investigators were already following up on the August 2nd incident report about the gunfire that Judy and Joe had heard, and doing their best to connect it to the Klisnikow murders. On August 24th, the day before the Heron neighbors had seen the smoke in his property, TBI agent Russell Winkler gave Mike Heron a call. Mike was in Arizona at the time, overseeing a huge commercial project, remodeling Jack in the Box restaurants in several states. Winkler's call to Heron, which was recorded and which we had the transcript for, was cryptic, and it wasn't initially clear why, but would become clear later. He told him that an anonymous source had informed the TBI that there were some people out in his property in the past few weeks. Mike responded, okay. Winkler then assured him, quote, "There's no reason for us to think you're involved in this or anything. A really strange thing to say because he doesn't identify what the thing is that he isn't involved in." What thing? Was he alluding to the Klisnikow murder, which hadn't been mentioned to Mike? And if so, did he just assume that Mike knew about it and knew about some connection to his farm? Well, clearly Mike didn't. He asked, what's going on? Winkler told him he couldn't elaborate any further and that neighbors had seen activity they were concerned about. So much for the anonymous source, but Mike may not have caught it because he was more concerned about what was going on at his property. He had it listed for sale and didn't want any damage to the place. Winkler asked that the TBI had Mike's permission to search the property, without any specifics about what they were looking for. Now, this was rather disingenuous, because they had already made a sweep of the entire barn on August 21st, the day after interviewing Judy and Joe about the gunfire they'd heard. They had found nothing. No shell casings, no bullets, not even fragments. They told Judy and Joe they'd be back the following week to conduct a more thorough search. We know this first search took place because Judy and Joe witnessed it and told events investigators about it. Of course, Winkler didn't mention any of this to Mike, and at trial he said he had no recollection of any search taking place before Mike had given them permission. Anyhow, Mike gave his permission on 2 conditions. First, they keep him updated with whatever they found, and second, they didn't damage his property by tearing it up for their investigation. Winkler also asked Mike who specifically had permission to be on the property in his absence. the real estate agent, of course, and also this guy who is helping him work on it, worked on his roof specifically. His name, Greg Lantz.
There are two fairly comprehensive reports in the case files written by Fire Marshal Philip Gentry at different points in the investigation. In the first report, he actually does in fact state that a search was done on August 21st. But in his second report, he nixes that altogether and moves that preliminary search to the 24th, after Winkler got permission from Mike Herron, fudging the paperwork, it seems, to cover their rear ends. Regardless, according to the reports, nothing suspicious was found during the preliminary search whenever it actually took place. But on August 26th, nine members of the TBI, ATF, State Fire Marshal's Office, and Putnam County Sheriff's Office descended on the Herron farm and conducted a thorough two-day search. Now remember, it was the late afternoon of August 25th, the day before, when the Powells had seen the smoke and the blue truck at the farm, and they alerted Judy and Joe, who then called Fire Marshal Philip Gentry. So when the authorities began searching the farm in that thorough two-day search, they already knew about the burned-up wood with the one bullet lodged in it, the one that Joe had found the evening before. And they came prepared to find more, with sifters and an ATF canine unit. You could say they hit gold. They found four casings and 24 projectiles of different calibers, including 9mm bullets like the ones involved in the Kolesnikow murders. Whether they were indeed fired from the same weapon as the one that killed Victor and Alla remained to be seen after the crime lab examined them. Now, you have to ask yourself this. How did dozens of bullets and casings show up at the Herron farm on the 26th, when 2 days prior, on the 24th, Gentry's report says that there was nothing there? Even if that preliminary search was done on the 21st and not the 24th, well, that's a lot of bullets to appear out of nowhere in a matter of days. That would seem to indicate either they did a piss-poor job looking during the preliminary search, or sometime in the days in between there was a ton of gunfire going off. But if that had been the case, it wouldn't have gotten past the Herons' neighbors, who were clearly keeping an eye on everything happening there, especially in those days.
There are reasons to be skeptical of both scenarios, and next week, we'll get deeper into the evidence there. But for now, this was just one more step to closing in on Greg. And it just so happened that while the investigators were out at the Herron farm on August 27th, still searching for evidence, a blue and white truck rolled past the farm and all the way down to Judy and Joe's. There were two men in the truck, and one of them came out to speak to Joe, who was outside of his house. The men in the truck said they were looking to buy rabbits, but Joe didn't have any to sell. He did have an old rabbit cage, though, and he agreed to sell them that. And as this negotiation was taking place, TBI agents pulled up behind the truck to see who the men were. According to a defense interview with Joe, Agent Krosick, who Joe described as having a forehead so long he could have had two faces, approached the truck and asked the men to identify themselves. One of the men responded that he didn't have to provide a name, at which point Krosick put his hand on his weapon and stated that the man was going to give him his name, and he did. Krosick wrote down their contact information and car tags because he was not about to let them walk away. But we'll get back to these men later on in the season because they both end up being rather important. In fact, both of them end up testifying for the state against Greg. Now, all these random happenings at the Herron farm in the month of August may seem, well, random, but the authorities didn't see it that way. Their grand unified theory of this case is that on the morning of August 2nd, 3 days before the murder, Greg had been target practicing at the Herron farm, and that's where he was spotted by Judy at about 1 p.m., where, according to Judy, she'd seen him standing there by the open truck of a brown car with a vinyl roof, and he was there with two women at the time. And Greg wasn't only practicing a shot. He was also there to quietly deposit two full containers of gas, which he planned on using later to burn down the Kolesnikow's house after the murder. After Mike Herron alerted Greg that there were TBI agents crawling all over the farm, Greg returned to burn evidence. And that was the source of the smoke and fire that was seen by the Powells and Joe and Judy around 4 p.m. that day. It's not clear why this plan would require target practice in advance, or why a suspect would return to a scene after being informed that it was crawling with TBI agents who were investigating. But anyway, at the end of 2 days of searching, Agent Russell Winkler called Mike Heron on August 27th and told him they were done investigating. He said that they cut a section from a tree that had projectiles lodged inside of it, and they were going to go test them. Winkler advised Heron that this was an ongoing criminal investigation in the Klisnikow matter, and asked if he'd informed anyone that they were going to be searching the property. Yes, said Mike. He'd told Greg about it. He'd been worried that the police were going to damage his place, so when he hadn't heard from Winkler earlier, Heron had called Greg and asked him to go by and check on the property. At that point, Mike Heron had no idea that Greg was a suspect because Greg hadn't said anything to him about it. In fact, he didn't even find out that Greg was a suspect until a couple weeks later, after Greg had joined him in Arizona to help with that big jack-in-the-box project. And when Heron called Greg to check on the property, there was nothing about Greg's reaction that Heron noticed that indicated he was alarmed by the request or by the presence of the cops there. Then again, Greg's lack of a reaction might also have been because there was no reason for Greg to have suspected that the search at the Heron farm had anything to do with the Kolesnikow's murder. And Greg didn't ask Heron what the police had done at the farm or if they'd found anything. As Mike put it, Greg was simply nonchalant about it all.
It's not clear at what point Mike Heron learned that the authorities believed that all the random activities at his farm were connected to the Klisnikow murders and thereby connected to Greg. But at trial, he was pretty clearly incredulous. He testified that it wasn't unusual for any of his friends to come by to go shooting, even when Mike was no longer living there. He was asked if his neighbors knew that his friends went shooting on his property. Had he told them specifically about it? Mike responded no, and said that he had cut off communications with Judy Wells and Joe Brown early in 1998, which is not only why Judy and Joe had no idea that Mike's friends had permission to come by and shoot there, but also why they had no idea that Mike actually had tenants in his property who rented out the house, meaning that of course there would be people in cars on and off the land.
I had renters that were out on that property at that time. Also, that place ended up burning down from the renters out there. They had lit a fire in an outside fireplace on the porch and burnt the house up. So,
wow.
And it's a fair guess that's why Joe and Judy never contacted Mike directly when they heard gunfire, saw smoke. And it also explains why when Winkler first contacted Mike, he told him the TBI got information from an anonymous source instead of naming Joe and Judy directly. If Mike had cut off communications with them, maybe they weren't really allowed to be on his property to begin with. In fact, at trial, Mike testified that he had specifically and only asked Greg to keep an eye on the property. He only called Greg to take a look when he learned of the police investigation. He never even bothered to reach out to his neighbors, and that certainly says something. Back to August of 1998. If there was anyone as eager to connect the events at the Heron Farm to the Klisnikow murders of the investigators, it seemed like it was Judy and Joe. An interesting coincidence is that the first time they contacted authorities also happened to be the exact same day the governor of Tennessee announced a $5,000 reward in the case. They called the police on August 20th, even though they heard the gunfire weeks earlier on August 2nd. That reward was announced in the local and state newspapers, and we know that Judy liked to go pick up her paper. Anyway, by the end of August, authorities began crafting a narrative, piecing together all that had happened at the Heron Farm that month with Greg and the murders. They had also started making traction and getting witnesses who knew Greg to start coming forward. Their case was slowly coming together. The only missing piece, a very big piece, was the murder weapon itself. But then, a couple of weeks later, they got the call they'd been waiting for.
At around 7 p.m. on the evening of September 17, 1998, Detective Gary Roach of the Putnam County Sheriff's Office took a call from a Mr. James Bohannon, a neighbor of Victor and Alla, who lived about a mile down the road from the Kolesnikow property. He had discovered something rather strange on his property, a firearm that he found while repairing the electrical fence that ran along Poplar Grove Road. Over a month had passed since his neighbors had been murdered, and Bohannon thought that maybe this gun had some connection to the crime. Bohannon told Detective Roach he routinely walked the land where he kept horses, inspecting and fixing his fences, cleaning up and keeping an eye out for things that might not belong. Because Poplar Grove Road ran next to his property, he had a number of large commercial billboards on it. There was actually both an external and internal fence that ran between the road and his property, and between the two fences, there was a path overgrown with weeds. That's where he found the gun, between those two fences, on that path, under a Subway sandwich shop billboard. He was wearing work gloves, and he gingerly pinched the gun between two fingers to find that the weapon was attached to a green cord fashioned into a sling, and it had a small black flashlight duct taped to the barrel. The gun looked rusty, and Bohannon's impression was that someone must have thrown it onto his property from a passing car. He walked the weapon back towards his house and tied it using that same cord that was attached to it to a part of the fence that ran in front of his front door. Then he went inside and told his wife what he found. By 9 p.m., Detective Roach and Fire Marshal Philip Gentry arrived to inspect the gun, and Bohannon showed them where he found it, just inside the fence that ran along the passenger side of Poplar Grove. Now, the road didn't run flush with his land. There were embankments that rose on both sides of the road in steep slopes, and from where Bohannon found the gun, he could look down onto the road from a good 6 to 8 feet high. So either someone had climbed up the bank and ditched the gun there, or they flung it out of a car from the road and it landed there. The gun was a Tech 9, a heavy semi-automatic pistol weapon that fired 9mm bullets, just like the ones that had killed Victor and Alec Klesnikow. Detective Roach noticed a partially chambered round and removed it and the magazine, which had a few more rounds in it, just to be safe, and then he bagged the gun. And then on the same day, he turned the gun over, along with the green cord and the flashlight still attached, to TBI agent Bob Krofsik. Given the proximity of the weapon to the scene of the Klesnikow murders, and the fact that the weapon had the same ammunition used to kill them, it seemed like a strong possibility to Krofsik that this could be the murder weapon they had been searching for. After all, if someone had been traveling from the victim's house towards town, they would have passed Bohannon's property on the right side. But it was strange that, in such a deeply wooded region with creeks and bridges and forests and fields, why the perp would dispose of the gun, if it was indeed the murder weapon, so close to the crime scene when they could have hidden it in so many other places. Anyway, Agent Krofsik already had results back from the bullets and bullet casings recovered from the Klesnikow house that had only taken 6 days from the day he had submitted the evidence. There was only one way now to find out if those bullets came from the weapon that was found on Bohannon's property, if indeed this was the murder weapon they'd been looking for over a month. So Agent Krofsik sent the Tech 9, complete with the flashlight and the cord still attached, to the TBI crime lab and hoped for the best. Next time on Undisclosed. Greg Lance has been in prison since 1999. If you'd like to drop him a note of support or a card or anything to let him know that you're following his story and thinking about him, address your letters to Gregory Paul Lance, ID 003-25463. The Bledsoe County Correctional Complex, BLEDSOE, Bledsoe County Correctional Complex, located at 1045 Horsehead Road in Pikeville, Tennessee. Zip code 37367. Now, lots of thank yous. A big thank you to all of our sponsors who helped make this episode, this series, and really all of our work possible. We could not continue to investigate wrongful convictions and try to help those wrongfully convicted if we didn't have our sponsors. So, if you want to support our work, if you want to support the folks that we are trying to help in our series, please support our sponsors. They make the production possible. Thank you to our Wizard of Oz, who keeps everything running like clockwork behind the scenes, executive producer Mithil Thelhan. Thank you to our audio producer extraordinaire, Rebecca Lavoy, host of one of my favorite podcasts, Crime Writers On. Thank you, Baluki, for our logo, Patrick Cortez for our theme song. Thank you to Linda Bozeman and the family of Greg Lance for working with us in order for us to do an investigation into this case. And a huge thank you to my legal intern for this entire series, Asa Qureshi, who has just put in days and days and weeks of going through documents and organizing things and just making my life easier. And finally, thank you all of our listeners for staying with us case after case, year after year. Follow us on social media. We're on Twitter at the handle @undisclosedpod, and remember to tweet us your questions for the undisclosed addendum using the hashtag UDaddendum. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, and our website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com.
With prices going up on just about everything lately, dealing with money can be stressful. If you follow stories about wrongful convictions, you know that details matter, and the same goes for your finances. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses in one place, including subscriptions you may have forgotten about. Their dashboard lays out your total financial picture in a way that's easy to understand. Rocket Money's 5 million members have saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, with members saving up to $740 a year when they use all of the app's premium features. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/budget today. That's rocketmoney.com/budget. rocketmoney.com/budget.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September. I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.